This on tape, would you mind telling me what your background was and how you came to work for the Fed and where you started?
Okay. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, just fine.
All right. I got my PhD in 1971. I think it was February, March. And I had written my thesis on the Federal Reserve, so it was a natural to consider employment there. And I started at the board in the spring of 71, near as I can remember.
Where did you start?
I started in the government finance section, which was then headed by Helmut Wendel. They had major responsibility for sort of, this is part of the old organizational structure then, but I think it was instructive about how the Fed thought about the markets. The government finance section, on the one hand, watched, quote unquote, the government securities market, and more generally the money and capital markets. And then on the other side was charged with coming up with estimates of the government's cash balance and associated financing needs, because this was viewed as a major factor influencing the dynamics of the market.
Let me just change track. Did you have a sense that Burns was as interested in watching financial markets as his predecessor, Martin, that he tried to get a sense of market psychology, or he was much less interested in financial markets and just more interested in watching the real numbers that came in, freight car loadings and purchasing managers' reports and all the information that comes in. Did you ever have a sense in kind of how much Burns was interested in your kind of how much you followed the market?
But let me just say that, you know, Burns and I arrived around the same time, so I never saw Martin,
right.
So I don't, other than what I read about Martin, and I did read a lot, that's indirect. Burns, I think it's fair to say that I think he started out thinking that the monetary side of things wasn't all that complicated, and he clearly was an expert with all the business cycle indicator type data. But I'm thinking, as you asked the question, I mean, how do you judge someone's interest? I'd say he asked just as many questions at the weekly briefings and other meetings I was at of the financial people as the non-financial people. I think he spoke with his questions of the non-financial people were awful. They're sort of like the interviewing of the O.J. Simpson case. It was like he already knew the answers to those. I think his questions on the financial side were more, you know, genuinely trying to understand what was going on. But I just don't recollect this notion that he was substantially more interested in the non-financial side.
Mm-hmm. What you say rings true, that he did not have a background in central banking and in financial markets. It's not where he, in his research, he had a lot to learn. But also, he attached a lot of importance to market psychology.
Absolutely.
He
wanted to know what the market, I mean, we used to sometimes try to tell him it was like looking in a mirror, but I mean, he was very interested in knowing what the market thought the Fed was going to do and what the market thought the Fed was looking at. And so we had to stay in touch with, I guess it was Alan Holmes and Peter Sterlight, because I did the briefing in those years almost every week or every other week on the markets. There was four briefings, as you probably know. One was on the sort of interest rates, financial markets, and the other was on the aggregates. And we had to make sure we talked to Sterlight, Holmes, or other people on the desk who sat in on the dealer meetings, for example, every morning, early in the morning. I assume they still do it.
Yeah.
It was a meeting with the dealers, and they wanted to know what those guys were thinking. And Burns wanted to know that. It was really important to him.
Did you ever become involved in Green Book and Blue Book preparation?
Yes.
And how did that happen? What was your...
Well, the sections job on the Green Book, you started out with that because at least the section's major part of that was not really the confidential
right.
parts. It was where you sort of cut your teeth. So it's what later became part two of the Green Book. And
right.
At this point, though, it was still sort of all one document, as I recollect it. The we wrote the part on what had happened since the last meeting to interest rates. That was one side, and why. And if there was something unexpected about the way rates moved, given where the funds rate turned out to be, there was a need to analyze that, put it in historical perspective, et cetera. And then the other part was to talk about the evolving Treasury financing patterns, innovations, if any, in debt management strategies, and the likely upcoming Treasury cash needs. And this was all folded in around the updated estimates of the high employment budget and the unified budget. So that was the Green Book part that the section worked on in those days, and I wrote more of those than I care to remember.
Who had overall responsibility for the Green Book?
Well, it was the Director of Research and Statistics, which I'm trying to think when Partee became head, but that's sort of my first recollection. Partee and then later Gramley mm-hmm. had overall responsibility because it was mainly a non-financial document, the Green Book. Mm-hmm. Now, you asked about the Blue Book. I went to the call every day, almost from the first day I was there, you know, the famous call.
Sure.
And our section was responsible for writing what was called the drafting for Axelrod, what was called the Blue Book Past, quote unquote. And that was the first three or four pages, which again summarized what had happened in the markets, but more focused now on how it all related to what the desk had done in the interim and how it had responded to incoming data, whether on the aggregates or anything else. So it was very much, I thought it was an executive summary for the FOMC of what had happened in financial markets vis-a-vis the implementation of policy. And in my early years there, that's Fred Struble, early on when I was still kind of young and inexperienced, he did most of that for Helmut Wendel, and then when Helmut moved on, Fred became section chief, and I took major responsibility for that.
In the process of writing this, did you have any sense of the extent to which the committee, in the absence of Burns, was moving toward reserve control? One of the views of this period, and it may be right or wrong, it's always hard to disentangle the kind of reality, was that given the experience in the late 60s, 68 especially, where there was general agreement that the Fed let money get out of hand, that there was a movement toward reserve control, the RPD experiment, the movement away from...
That's 72, the RPDs, though.
Yeah, and then this the kind of standard story is that all this was short-circuited, especially in early 72 when Burns imposed a very strict limit on the extent to which he was willing to raise the funds rate in order to...
Well, given the Committee on Interest and Dividend stuff, I think the RPDs, this is my personal view now, and I think you have to use this kind of information carefully, but I thought it was pretty much a sham and illusion. I mean, I don't think there was really any discernible move inside the board. I think it was some members of the FOMC who wanted to do this as-if experiment. You know, what would have happened if we were on a reserve path? I think they were particularly interested in what would have happened to interest rates, not what would have happened to the aggregates.
Yeah, yeah.
And a kind of indication of it was, my recollection is the first time the RPD PAC tables were done, they had Jim Pierce do it, who was on completely the other side of the operation.
Yeah.
And to me, that said something about how serious they were. Not that Jim wasn't a capable guy and well-liked and all that, but it was, sure. It was like, oh, this was sort of academic interest as opposed to being of serious policy importance. And, I mean, my view at that time was that they felt they had to do it to mollify some members of the FOMC, but that Sternlight and Holmes and Burns and therefore Axelrod, who was the key actor here,
yeah.
were going to sort of do it, but, you know, give lip service to it every once and again, say, well, what would have been true if we were on that path? And that was it. I didn't feel... And I was pretty eclectic at this moment. I didn't have any axe to grind either way. I was in 72 still trying to figure out what was happening. I mean, I felt that it was not a serious move in that direction.
There was another, I don't know, reform movement's the right word, but a movement to rethink procedures. I'm not sure. Committee on the directive or subcommittee on the directive, it involved... I know on the regional bank level it involved Kieran, but on another at the board level it involved Tinsley and Kulchbrenner and I suppose Bob Holland. Was there ever any serious move along those lines?
I don't think so. Holland, you know, a wonderful guy, pleasant guy, but he was in Burns's hip pocket in those days. I mean, whatever Burns wanted, Holland was going to say and do, and he was part of that group to make sure that these guys who were then over in Watergate didn't run off in a crazy direction. And, you know, these are the days when Kulchbrenner and Pierce and Tinsley were working in optimal control theory.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember this meeting that they had with Burns. This came later. But Burns, you know, they had worked on this thing for a year and a half or something. Burns gave him about 5 minutes.
This would have been March 76.
Yeah. You know, Burns gave about 5 minutes and said, I don't think we're ready for this.
Yeah, that was the first meeting that the FOMC stopped taking minutes. But now that there are transcripts available, presumably they'll work back to that
period. Right.
And we'll,
I think these were all indicators of, you know, it was nice to have the Kulchbrenners and Tinsleys around, but I think they were often used in ways that were not a part of the serious re-examination or ongoing examination of the wisdom of current procedures. I mean, I don't want to say everyone had a closed mind in the key positions, but I think the lead did come from the chair, and the chair, Burns, was not really very much interested in any of these changes. It kind of reminds me, I'm on the board of directors of an insurance company now, and I try to talk to them about derivatives and how they can help you manage risk. Well, they don't want to talk about it at all.
Was there anybody on the FOMC or staff level, for that matter, who would challenge Burns, or did Burns just tower over everyone?
Oh, I mean, I'm sure, you know, I mean, the St. Louis, for example, the St. Louis Fed president, Cleveland or Chicago, but I think he was such an imposing figure and had such command of the current data.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like when he testified in front of Congress. I mean, if no one had ever seen him inside the FOMC, seeing him in front of Congress was very similar in that he could say, well, this reminds me of the panic of, you know, 1907, and we got to be careful, and everyone would sort of melt away. I mean, I think Brimmer, Sherman Mazel in the early days would try to ask analytical questions, but they were not, I mean, in terms of the average economic literacy of the board, they were above average at the time, but if Burns didn't like the questions they were asking in terms of what implications about after policy, he just shut them off. He'd just say, well, we've discussed that enough. Let's move on. So you only have to get stepped on like that a few times, I think, before you sort of challenge him less when you think you might be on the other side.
I understand he was particularly curt with Al Hayes, the New York Fed.
I think that's fair.
I'm hesitant to ask us to think about why we use the Green Book and whether it couldn't be done in a more useful way.
Right.
So I've got a couple general questions. To what extent, if any, does economic theory impose coherence on Green Book projections? And how does the FOMC use the analytical capabilities of the staff, apart from its information gathering capabilities, if at all? So I'd like to ask you some general questions about how the board put together the Green Book in those days. It's gotten some, the procedure's gotten somewhat more organized. I understand Jim Kickline imposed some more order on it. The way the procedure starts now is that the staff director makes an assumption about what the FOMC wants to do with inflation and unemployment. Now that's kind of implicit, and he never says where that comes from, but presumably that reflects the chairman's point of view. And I mean, was there any, did you have any sense of that, of the of at the time when the individual groups doing the Green Book were asked to make their projections, how did the staff director impose some?
Oh yeah, there was
some discipline.
I used to see this with the Blue Book with Axelrod. It was more obvious there because the group was smaller and we were spending a lot of time with Axelrod. But in the Green Book, it would be you'd sort of start off early with this omnibus meeting that, you know, had the appearance. It always had the appearance of, okay, we're starting off just with the last forecast and let's see what everyone thinks. But depending on who the staff director was at the time, and, you know, it changed over time, you know, Partee, Gramley, Kickline, you know, they had different styles. But, I mean, there was never a doubt in my mind that they had talked with the chairman about what direction the forecast, the baseline forecast, might be shaded in. I mean, because they, I think, you know, they're like a lot of people in positions like that. They're risk averse to some degree. So they don't want to be too far away, probably, from, or they certainly want to know what their principal, it's a principal agent problem. They certainly want to know what the principal thinks, and they figure they can make the argument, if they really feel strongly, by shading relative to that that prior on the part of the principal. So anyway, they'd come together, the so-called, you know, say the Jared Enslers of the world, you know, he had the model. And then you had all the people doing the sectors, you know, consumption, investment, you know, somebody like Steve Roach, for example, who's the chief economist now at Morgan Stanley and who you might profitably talk to. And, you know, it would be, well, what do you think relative to where we were last time? And then they'd ask the model runner to sort of put the model through a baseline forecast to see how much sense it all made sector by sector, because these forecasts, as you know, they weren't just GDP and prices. I mean, it was all the details of consumption, investment, et cetera. But in the end, it was going to be the staff director who decided what the top-line numbers were going to be.
So the model just imposed an accounting coherence.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, things had to
add up.
And that sort of consistency check and some sort of historical relationships between some of the key, you know, say an inventory sales ratios and the overall strength of aggregate demands. But I think, you know, Gramley and Partee especially stick out of my mind here because they had. They viewed themselves as pretty damn good GNP forecasters.
Mm-hmm.
And now I remember, I'm going to try to get the timing right here, but I think, and this will illustrate the point I was trying to make, I'm pretty sure, geez, it's 72, I'm thinking of the spring of 72, but I could be off. The staff was of the view that the economy was in a strong upward move.
Yeah, that would have been spring 72 or spring 71, either one.
But Burns was not. So now the question, and you know, so here's the staff trying to push him, I think, to push up rates. And he's on the other side. So the dynamics of the Blue Book and Green Book in that period are particularly interesting with regard to the point you're examining here. Because I'm sure that Gramley, Partee, Axelrod were trying to find ways to edge the funds rate up, quote unquote, more than Burns was ready to tolerate.
Mm-hmm. He was talking about, there's so much pessimism on the part of the consumer, and the businessman is feeling just in this, you know, given the degree of, and that's what Burns was saying. Did you have a sense that assumptions were being made about Fed objectives? That is, now if you look at a green book, and if you take a forecast 6 quarters out, and then they weren't 6 quarters out, but now if you take one 6 quarters out, you can read off what the staff director thinks the chairman's objective for inflation is. Because he's not gonna give a 6% figure for inflation a year and a half from now or 2 years from now if the chairman thinks we ought to keep inflation at 3%. Did you have any sense of that, of being able to read objectives out of the Green Book, or was the whole emphasis kind of near term where monetary policy wasn't?
Well, it was near term, and interestingly enough, Axelrod thought the notion that a forecast was a target. In fact, I think you can actually find a discussion of this. You know, you're sort of waking old dogs up here. I think the first, maybe it was the second Boston Fed conference, I think it has sort of a green, part green on the cover.
Yeah.
That Darwin Beck and Axelrod have a paper in that one. And somewhere there, Axelrod talks about projections and targets. And now he's talking about it in terms of the aggregates, but this was something, you know, because we would always give them the standard revealed preference argument, right? I mean, if that's the forecast, and then they don't alter policy, they either don't believe the forecast, or that's their objective for the near term. Well, you know, you couldn't get into a dialogue. I think he was worried about the politics of all this, actually.
Yeah. Well, let's pursue that a little bit more. Process works now is that. Well, Prell has some idea of what the chairman wants in the way of inflation rate in the next year out, and he's got some idea of what's acceptable in terms of the behavior of the unemployment rate. And then he's got an interest rate path, and he takes the interest rate path from last meeting,
right.
And then he sees what's happened in terms of incoming information and what the yield curve has done, and he'll adjust that interest rate path. And then he gives everybody this interest rate path. People make their individual forecasts. They put the forecast together for real economic activity. They use a Phillips curve to come up with a forecast for inflation. And then Prell looks at that and sees if it's a lot different from what he thinks is acceptable, then there's this iterative process.
Right.
He'll throw out another interest rate path, and they'll go through the process again until they come to something.
I mean, in many ways, I guess this, I would guess it would be probably your maintained hypothesis. The words change, the documents look different, but a lot doesn't change at all.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that sounds much different from the way I remember it.
Was there an explicit interest rate path?
Well, I was just,
to you then, or?
There was two things that are relevant here. I mean, you got to distinguish between, and I don't want to sound like a disgruntled staff member because I wasn't. I mean, I enjoyed being there. You enjoyed trying to nudge them in a more analytical direction, you know. I'm not complaining about Axelrod. He had a different job, but he had to answer to his principals. But I think you have to distinguish between sort of the top-line staff, say, you know, what now is the staff director for monetary policy and the head of R&S, and the staffs underneath them, okay? Mm. I mean, they may have somewhat different objectives. And I remember what I would call the second line staff, more or less continually, whether we're talking about the Blue Book or Green Book, trying to get more economic analysis into every one of these documents. And the analysis might be a paragraph here, a sentence there. And I'm going to come back and give you an example of a bulletin article in a couple minutes of this. But I remember with specific regard to this that we would try to get the path, the implied path for short and long-term interest rates into the Blue Book, even as an appendix. And we would try to get the implied path for velocity, the appendix. And it, as you go through the history of those documents, you'll see that once in a while that stuff appears for a while, and then it disappears. And I think the way Axelrod would put it is, oh, well, no one's looking at it. We don't need it. We got to make the document shorter. Or he'd say, they're subject to so much error, we shouldn't even put them in there. It erodes the staff's credibility, right?
Yeah.
But the second line staff was trying to, say, look, does that implied movement of velocity make sense vis-a-vis anything we look at, et cetera? The bigger example I was going to give you is, I think there's a bulletin in article in 1974 on inflation. It could be 75, but it's sort of the surge in prices. And if you read that article, I remember the poor guy that got stuck having to draft it. I mean, you hear about anchovies and you hear about commodity prices, and you know you really don't hear about monetary policy.
Yeah.
And that was the subject of much discussion inside the Fed. That article was symptomatic of what had been missing from the underlying work that the staff was doing for the FOMC in the preceding 2 years. Remember, we had come through a period when the staff thought things were going to be stronger and prices were going to be higher, but that got squashed out more or less each month as the Green Book and Blue Book unfolded.
So the staff forecasts of inflation were often higher than what was...
That's what I'd say.
Did you have a sense that the person organizing the Green Book exercise party was being explicit about monetary policy, or was kind of ambivalent, like these are unconditional forecasts and they're just out for a couple quarters, it doesn't make any difference what monetary policy is, or he was pretty explicit? He
said, I think actually the view was, and they might have not have been wrong, that even if the funds rate was another 25 or 50 basis points higher, would that have made a hell of a lot of difference over the relevant policy horizon? I mean, and that's another issue. It seems to me that the staff might have been unwittingly sort of a party to what was going on by sort of delivering forecasts, and I'll come back to a point on this, that seemed to suggest that the relevant horizon for operating on these variables was a hell of a lot shorter than it was. And then I'll give you an example of that. In the Blue Book, you know, there'd be these three alternatives, you know.
Yeah, sure.
And you'd have to show, all right, so now they're going to be 2 months. You'd sort of at the beginning of 1 month, and I think in these days it was probably 2 month rates of growth.
That's right.
And, well, basically, you were talking about 1 month. By the time the FOMC met and, you know, all this happened, well, I mean, the funds rate would move up, I don't know, in the midpoint, you can get them, would move up or down 50 basis points, and we would show a couple percentage point difference between A and C on the aggregates, and excess reserve demands would look different, yet we had no statistical model that showed an interest elasticity anywhere near that large. But Axelrod would say they just don't believe it. They don't believe that they can move the funds rate and nothing happens for a few months or a few quarters if we're talking about GNP. They don't believe it. So we have to show them some noticeable change. And this debate would be more or less continual. And that's what I mean about the top line staff and the second line staff.
But the other side of that is, if you really don't think that expenditures are interest elastic in the near term, or that money demands interest elastic in the near term, then you want to do long range forecasts out to the point where you do have some effect as a way of.
Oh, I agree with that.
But if you do just primarily short term forecast, 3 or 4 quarters, then you're not really. You're not really offering advice to the FOMC on what the effect of its actions are going to be. Mostly what you're doing is just organizing incoming data in a convenient way.
It's a dilemma, and that's why I mean that, you know, it's partly a missionary educational process that the staff plays. But I think the more you feed in, now let's suppose you have a group of people there that thinks they can affect what inflation rate we're actually going to have in August. I mean, this is really dangerous in many ways. In some sense, they think they can wait a while longer. In another sense, they have, you know, way too truncated a view, of the way the economy probably operates for the most part. And so, I mean, I think this was a dilemma. You know, are they going to listen to you? Are you going to be relevant? This also came into play, by the way, with revisions. In fact, I had one of my graduate students work on this for a thesis. When the staff's view changed, the question was, how far do you go in the direction of the change? If you're making big changes every month, are they going to listen to you? So is there an incentive to smooth the revisions so that you're moving in the right direction, you recognize there's a certain degree of randomness here, and you don't undermine your credibility. If you spend a lot of time developing the long-range forecast, and then 3 weeks later you have a view that's more sanguine, let's say, well, maybe the next time they're not going to listen to you. And I used to hear that from the top-line guys also.
Mm. Well, there's another sort of an analog to that, that is, you can exercise is to take the FOMC objectives and then come up with the optimal interest rate path that'll give you those achieve those objectives. And if you really believe in optimal forecasts, where forecast revisions are white noise, you're going to get white noise changes in the funds rate, and you're going to get pretty big jumps.
Right.
If you make explicit these recommendations for the funds rate, and the funds rate's jumping all over and up and down, that's probably the rational thing to do, but you're going to be totally ignored because there's no way the FOMC is going to accept anything other than persistent small changes in the funds rate.
I agree.
This is kind of a big question, but it's kind of somewhat in the background of the things we've been saying. Ultimately, did you have a sense of what Burns thought the Fed's responsibility for inflation was? Did you have the sense that he thought, you know, the way Greenspan would now, or Volcker did, that yes, the Fed is the agency that's responsible for inflation, and that, you know, Burns simply miscalculated? He thought that what was important was the psychology of the consumer and the businessman and their optimism or pessimism and how much they would spend, and he simply just grossly misjudged the effect the Fed would have on inflation. Or he really did believe the kinds of things he said, that inflation came from labor unions and the Fed, you know, either accommodated or it didn't, and, you know, it had this dilemma. Did you have a sense ultimately of...
I think if we use the old Volcker term of practical monetarism, that one would judge Volcker and Greenspan both being more practical monetarist than Burns. I remember a test, I think it's a testimony, it's in the Havrilesky and Borman first issue of their book, Current Issues of Monetary, it was a group of readings, Current Issues of Monetary Theory and Policy, and in there somewhere they have I believe it's testimony for Burns, where he's sort of responding to this notion that the inflation in 73-74 was the Fed's fault. And he said, no, that's nutty, and he has some numbers, and he said, talks about Milton Friedman, and and says that's a relationship that is very loose. It might hold over, you know, decades.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he really believed that, that he, in the long run, you had to get control of the aggregate, sure, but in the short run, there was a host of other things.
Mm-hmm.
I think he actually believed that fiscal policy was a hell of a lot more important at the time than a lot of other people thought. I guess a lot of Fed chairmen have thought that, but I used to think about the Committee on Interest and Dividends. You know, why the hell would he agree? One argument is that he thought the Fed would lose its independence, I guess. But another one might be that he thought there was a vehicle that he might be able to use to kind of get fiscal policy to be a less destabilizing force, that he had sort of this grand plan about how it could all work out. But I think he really believed that a depreciation was inflationary, that a rise in the anchovy prices was I think he really believed that. And that the Fed's role here was limited. I have a quote somewhere in one of my papers where he even says the Fed's role in influencing the balance of payments is very limited. I mean, this is an astounding quotation, I thought.
Well, he was very much into intervention and with swaps and, you know, the sterilized much importance to, but he really did attach importance to that kind of intervention.
Yeah.
My own feeling is that we find him hard to think about because our idea of what defines an economist is so standard, and we think, oh yeah, you know, monetarists are very different than Keynesians and very different than rational expectations and very different than real business cycle, yet all of these people, they're basically neoclassical economists. They think in terms of highly aggregated, simple models that are characterized by structural rate relationships that are based on optimizing behavior, permanent income hypothesis, life cycle behavior. But Burns came before that. He wasn't a neoclassical economist in the sense that we think of him. He had this incredibly detailed knowledge of the cyclical behavior and interrelationship between series. And he tied everything together by psychology, by ways of optimism and pessimism. He didn't tie things together with the kinds of optimizing framework that economists use. And he could look at the world and see different things than, you know, Milton Friedman or James Tobin, for that matter, would see.
Yeah, I remember, there actually is a great exchange here, and I don't remember the time, but it's got to be somewhere in 74, 75, I'd be guessing, in front of the Senate Banking Committee, and he gives his opening, Proxmire gives his opening statement saying things are going to hell in a handbasket. And he says, what do you think of that, Chairman Burns? And Burns pokes around his pipe for a while and says, I'd say you're a pessimistic man, Mr. Chairman. And he goes on to talk about that he's just more optimistic about the resilience of the American economy. And I think he believed it. It was not just rhetoric trying to cover the Fed's ass, because I saw him inside. And I think I know how he was moving his hand to influence the Green Book and Blue Book numbers. And I think one would have to conclude that, based on what you were seeing, that he actually believed in him. And I can't believe he believed that moving the funds rate 25 basis points in those days made a difference.
Mm-hmm. Well, one gets the feeling somewhat that if that he was willing to trade with the administration the way Martin was in the last half of the '60s. That is, Martin attached an enormous importance to fiscal policy, couldn't care less about the rate of growth of money. Burns cared a lot about microeconomic intervention. He really cared about Davis-Bacon legislation, about depreciation schedules, and the council and the Nixon administration, on the other hand, really cared about those St. Louis equations, and they really believed that they could control aggregate demand with money growth. They just didn't have a good idea of the Phillips curve, and you know, they thought they were naive about the extent to which they could exploit it. So it's kind of like if the two could get together, Burns would give the administration money growth because he didn't think it mattered that much in the
right
short run, and then he got things that he wanted in terms of the size of the deficit, suspension of Davis-Bacon, various kinds of tinkering with investment tax credit and so on?
You go back to, economists retreat to reveal preference. And so I haven't got the specific numbers at my fingertips, but I think the quote-unquote money target in 71, mid-71, was somewhere around 3-4%. And by late 72 or early 73, the explicit target they were voting on was 6-7%, somewhere in that range. So things have gone up a lot. Now, if you ask Burns, well, Jesus, isn't that going to mean more inflation? Well, he'd give you the standard money demand story. Now, I thought, he can't really believe this. He can't believe that this has been a shift in money demand that ought to be accommodated. I guess this is the sort of beginning of the missing money story. And isn't it that he just wants to try to hold interest rates down for the Committee on Interest and Dividends, and he thinks they can take it all out later, and that it probably won't matter that much anyway? Well, I suppose we'd have to go back and try to disentangle what exactly he was saying and doing, but there was this, I guess I'd focus on what happened to the money targets, at least to some degree. They allowed those to continue going up, even though money growth was accelerating, and even though the staff, as best as I can recollect it, was telling them that there was way too much stimulus in the economy.
Well, I think that this is just my surmise, but I really think Burns thought that the primary determinant of expenditure was velocity, not money, and that depended upon psychology, the psychology of consumers and investors, and that he had this NBER framework where he could follow the leading indicators and he could read the tea leaves and the near-term behavior of the economy, and he could go period by period, and it didn't make a lot of difference what money was doing. He figured he could stand in control, and he was wrong. This gets us into the issue everybody talks about, and people within the Fed have very different opinions about it. The extent to which Burns was sensitive to the desires of the administration, because if you go back and you look at this period, you look at what happened when he came on as chairman in February 70, you look at what happened in early 71 when the administration first became seriously concerned it wasn't going to get 4% employment by November 72. You look at what happened in 1972, particularly the first part of the year. I mean, monetary policy, whether you look at interest rates or money growth, I mean, it is moving around. It's not unrelated to what, the administration was concerned about. You think that Burns, basically just was getting what he thought he needed to keep inflation down in the way of wage and price controls and was willing to kind of trade, or?
I don't know what the story is on the, the famous Brimmer story. I really don't.
What's the Brimmer story?
Didn't Brimmer claim that Burns walked into some FOMC meeting with some note at some point that the president wants this or that?
No, that was an article in Fortune magazine by Pete.
I know that, but it was alleged Brimmer was the leak, I think.
No, Brimmer actually defended Burns in public. I don't think any allegations were ever made about who leaked the story. Our shop said that they thought Lionel Anderson from St. Louis probably.
Well, anyway.
But
I think the senior staff and Burns were mortified with the possibility that Nixon might lose. Mm-hmm. You just tell by the kind of comments people make and what implications it has for the future of the nation, et cetera. How does this subliminally, if not overtly, influence the way you respond today versus tomorrow to what you're looking at in the data. You know, I guess we need a psychologist to help us. But I know I sure felt at the time that if there was a way to delay, they would try to find it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's kind of what that's kind of what
there's a lot of political business cycle literature. You know, I mean, I sure felt it being there then. I mean, no one ever says anything. I think we ought to not raise the funds rate because the election's coming.
Sure.
And we want Nixon to win. I didn't hear anyone say that, but it seemed to me that that was a factor. Now, different staff are going to have different views, I suppose, but I was pretty close to what was happening. And like I said, I'm just inferring, interpolating from the comments that I heard about what was going on in the campaign at the time. More generally, I mean, Byrne said, I mean, isn't he given credit for founding the Council of Economic Advisors?
He's given credit for resuscitating it after Kaiserling made it very political in the Truman administration.
Right.
Wanted to use it as a vehicle for
something. I think
planning.
There's sort of two things going on here. Well, one is I think he valued his counsel being sought by the administration and him being in that circle.
Mm-hmm.
That, I think he did not want to have a Lyndon Johnson kind of experience if he could avoid it.
What's the reference to?
Well, this stuff about Martin and the discount rate and Johnson and, you know, that old story.
Yeah, December 65.
He wanted to be part of the inner circle, I think. And I remember thinking at the time, but I don't care where you stand on independence of the Fed, formal and informal, but this is too cozy in some ways, especially given what was going on. Now, the other thing that's relevant here is the whole Bretton Woods situation and Connally's tenure at the Treasury. I don't think he thought very much of Connally.
I don't see how he could have.
And I think that probably, now we're doing real psychoanalysis, I know at the time I felt that he owed the president more than he would normally get from the chairman of the Fed because he was probably getting bad advice from Connally.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was this whole notion of how do you get from 71 to 73 here? I mean, that's another issue that's running around. I mean, besides wage and price controls and all. Another factor that was leading him to try to be, cordial to the White House rather than otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, on your first point, I'll tell you something our director of research said, and this is the kind of thing you don't remember if you didn't live through the period, but Mr. Parthemis told me that, you know, at the time, which you know, of course, since you lived through it, there was this enormous social divisiveness because of the war and the student protests. You'd had the campus protests, the Nixon people, that really disturbed them. You know, of course, they thought it was being organized by communists, that kind of thing. But Burns really felt that American society was being challenged, and he would say things like this blessed civilization, this blessed America, and he thought it was under attack, and he thought it was under attack by the student radicals and especially by the labor unions.
Yeah, I agree.
And he was willing to trade off. And this wasn't just his view, this was a common view among businessmen. Anyone who was a quote political conservative thought that the order of American society was being threatened by the power of labor unions and these other challenges to authority. And Burns thought that the government needed to exert authority, we needed these kinds of government controls, and that he was willing to cooperate with the Nixon administration to get those controls, the wage and price controls that he thought were, you know, essential to kind of saving sense.
Oh, absolutely. I think you know, you make a good point, and you know, I remember remember there was a briefing, 74-ish, where I think it was a sort of pre-FOMC briefing, because the FOMC wanted to know about this, sort of what was the contribution of all these factors to the acceleration of inflation. And they came up with sort of an inflation accounting. And he heard the first half of the briefing, and he decided the contribution of the so-called special factors was way too small, and the contribution of policy was way too big, and they'd have to call off the briefing for the FOMC until the numbers could be reworked.
Yeah, well, he remained, even in 74, he remained an advocate of wage and price controls, and Greenspan won argument.
Yeah, my point, I guess my comment was a little point. I agree with your assessment of that what really we might call political economy, I guess,
mm-hmm.
for the intersection between the long-run political ramifications versus the what he would judge to be the short-run economic ramifications of what they were up to.
Yeah. How long did you remain at the Fed?
I left in March of 77.
Mm-hmm. So you left. So you were pretty much coterminous with Burns, actually.
It was all my fault, Bob.
Did you have the sense? 77 was a difficult year for us. I'd come here in fall 75, and you know I'd come as a monetarist. And by then, our bank had pretty much made the shift to quantity theory view of looking at things. We were enormously frustrated in 77 with Burns. Presumably the answer there is just relatively straightforward, that he was trying to get reappointed.
Yeah, and I think he was not very tolerant by this point of, not that he ever was, but he was more overtly intolerant of any challenge. You know, so these, my timing recollection may be wrong, but he was cutting off Reserve Bank access to the full model, to the Green Book, to the Blue Book, in various ways. I mean, it was not a good period, I think, from that point of view. And
he was never very tolerant to begin with.
I think he viewed the Reserve Banks as an irritant. We didn't need them, and they were a pain. I remember when John Paulus went out to be director of research at Minneapolis, and Mark Willis was the president. Willis used to keep asking him, "Well, how can I be more effective?" And Paulus just said, "Become chairman. You aren't going to be effective from out here."
Yes, I'm afraid that's true.
I'm going to have to run, Bob, here in about 2 minutes. We can, continue this at another time, but I'm going to have to get to another meeting.
No, I think we're winding up. You mentioned some names of people I haven't talked to yet. All these people would be useful to talk to. Helmut Wendel, John Paulus, Steve Roach.
Yeah.
Okay.
I would say.
Would you have phone numbers for any of those individuals, or just try to?
Let's see here. I have Paulus. Yeah, Paulus is at home in Connecticut. He's now you'll get his answering machine because he doesn't answer the phone during the day, but he'll call you back. If you just leave a short message and use my name, say I suggested it.
Okay.